Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be looking back at The Reading Life in 2022 in the first of two programs. This week, we look back on some of the events and books that made 2022 so memorable. For festival organizers and booksellers, first of all, it was a great year of return. In-person events and programming were back, bringing readers and writers together again. Like the saying goes, we may read to know we're not alone, but we like to get together and talk about it too. There were a number of great debuts this year. New Orleans native Elizabeth Tran crafted an insightful look at the New Orleans Vietnamese community and Daughters of the New Year. You wrote this book to answer your own questions about your family's history, and so much of it draws on your own background.
Yes.
And it's just fascinating that your family had one of the first Vietnamese grocery stores. Mm-hmm. Your father published the Vietnamese newspaper.
Yes.
I mean, what was it like? I saw that picture of the grocery store, which had a lending library of mm-hmm. Vietnamese books.
Yes.
So you grew up, obviously, in a place where books and writing were very valued.
Yeah. You know, I don't think I realized how much emphasis reading and literature had in our family until I became older.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's like part of what I'm wrestling with in writing the book is that like there's so much in my family that I just was unaware of or was there the whole time, but I ignored it in adolescent kind of self-centeredness. You know, one of the things I look back on in speaking of adolescent self-centeredness is Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
In that like at the time when I was 16 and we had to evacuate and we went to Baton Rouge to stay with my family. And I just remember the whole time thinking, oh, what an inconvenience to me. And like, I can't believe I'm going through this. I have to like stop going to school and, you know, all these different things
yeah.
that are uprooted from my life. And my parents are doing this to me. And, you know, as an adult now, I look back and it's like, I think part of it is because you view them more as human beings as you get older, right? Like you view your parents as people that have flaws and go through things and feel emotions, or really realize like, okay, their whole lives are uprooted and it's not just happening once, it's happening twice. Yes, this is the second time, if not more than that, that this has happened to them. So I never really realized that my father in particular was very, very literary.
Mm-hmm.
And he really
Tell
rooted
about
us.
His book, the book he wrote, which is...
Yes. It's gigantic. It's
yeah,
like humongous. He passed away in 2021. And
I'm so sorry.
Yes, it was very upsetting. But he finished his book before he passed away. So he like realized this lifelong dream of like writing this gigantic book. And in the last years of his life, every time I would speak to him, it was about this book. Like he was just, let me tell you about my book. I'm like, what are you doing? What are you up to today? He's like, working on my book. I would kind of ask him like, what is the book about? And what's funny is that he would tell me it's about everything pretty much, which is essentially like saying it's about nothing.
Of course.
So, I mean, I think that that's like the central, like that is why I think throughout my life, I've known very little or I've had very little connection to my culture is because it was very easy for me to just be like, oh, okay, like he already told me about it or like I already know about this, so I'm not going to delve further, because the answer was always a kind of skirting around the truth or like such a broad statement like, oh, it's, you know, it's about everything.
That was then and this is now. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, because I was older, I began and because I was starting to write the book at that time, and I was also writing about like my family and about mm-hmm. our history. I had caught on to their tricky ways. And, you know, I was a little bit better about asking questions. So his book was actually about, you know, he wasn't lying. It was about apparently all literature, Vietnamese literature from the beginning, he says, up into the present, which is a huge undertaking. It's more of like a literary history, mm-hmm. I would say. And his whole project was, you know, after leaving Vietnam, you know, after the fall of Saigon, the communists, with many new regimes, they get rid of all of the literature, all of the culture, the cultural artifacts that contradict what they want the history to be. And so he felt like his generation was disappearing or was being erased. And so his whole project was to reestablish that. So I feel like that is like something that I've always been very fascinated with in my own writing too, just like not necessarily reestablishing history, but watching him do it.
Of course. And seeing the enormity of the task.
Yeah, it's huge.
You know, but the modeling of the writing life for you.
Yes. Yeah, he was very, very structured, and he always put his writing first.
Another memorable debut was The Ballad of Perilous Graves by Alex Jennings, which shows us an alternative vision of this city, bereft of its musical soul. And there were new books from established writers. Ramadan Ramsey by Lewis Edwards took some 20 years to write, but it was worth the wait. One of the things I love about this book is that sense of urgency. And there's tragedy, to be sure, as there is in life. There's loss of loved ones, Hurricane Katrina, including a view from inside the Superdome, a second line shooting. But there's constantly forward movement, and Ramadan keeps rushing headlong through life and through the world. And it's almost as if the world conspires to help him.
This is true. In a way, it's true of life. I mean, I felt that with this book because Ramadan wanted to do what he wanted to do. He wants to find that force that created him. And I couldn't stop him.
You were along for the ride.
I was along for the ride. So I had to figure out each step of the way. Logistically, right? There's a lot of logistics that go into getting this little kid from New Orleans all the way to Aleppo.
Right? On his own steam.
On his own steam. And there's a little luck along the way, but there's a lot of ingenuity. You know, he's very special and he's talented, but he's a regular kid, you know, from Treme. Right? He's a sixth ward kid, you know, who figures all this out for himself. He's got a great grandmother, a very powerful woman, complicated, who helps him all along the way. He's got this family that's there that spurs him on in unsuspected ways. And he makes the leap from that front porch and he's on his way. And I'm following him.
And so are we. So read a little bit for us from a passage called Interludes, because it kind of gives a taste of the energy of this text.
I would love to. I mentioned earlier that I'm a traveler. And so I think that's where this came from.
I'm glad you're back.
Thank you. Felt like I've been around the world. Taking Flight, this sort of interlude is called. Here we go. Have you ever been to Rome? Have you ever set out for Paris? Ever jetted off to any foreign land to fulfill a dream or escape a nightmare? Or like Ramadan, thrillingly, to do both at once? If so, then you have an idea what taking flight incites in him, how a continental shift can promote a constitutional one. You know the change that being set in motion can, well, set in motion. You know how motion can precipitate emotion. Moving is moving. You may not have devised, who has, a method for calculating the degree to which kinetics stimulates the intellect, physics modifies psychology, but you know all too well that the distance between where you disembark and where you land is only crudely measurable in miles or kilometers, and more accurately mapped in feelings and revelations. And if you haven't been anywhere, well, what the hell are you waiting for? A hurricane? A war, a literal shot in the arm, a cure for the plague, that is fear, an invitation. Birth is your invite, breath your passport, bravery your visa. In a way, The notion of birth, earthly or otherwise, is precisely the point. Home is a womb. It nurtures. But imagine never pushing forth into the world, your growth inhibited by habitat, the comfy confines of your mother's accommodating girth. Wouldn't persistent satiation feed a need? Wouldn't nourishment, without growth, nurture a longing, create, in effect, an appetite for hunger? Thus, your stasis, replete with life's necessary nutrients, would equal starvation. Feast would become famine, with the usual dire consequences. To remain fetal would be fatal. Oh, to be Ramadan, who parallel to this pause is plunging head first, with a tender spot on his forehead from that bump against the airplane window to prove it, into another world. Him today, you tomorrow. Why not? What's a bruise on the noggin, or any other part of the body, when the trade-off is a balm for the soul? You pack for the trip, of course, clothes, toiletries, a snack or two, but really, your only carry-on is you.
Lady Hubbard gave us a brilliant story collection in The Last Suspicious Holdout, and Zachary Lazar painted a nuanced portrait of expat life in the apartment on Calle Uruguay. Claudia Gray began a new series featuring the Jane Austen character, Mr. Wickham, and James Lee Burke was back with Every Cloak Rolled in Blood. New Orleans native Margaret Sexton in On the Rooftop traveled to a California setting to take on the issues of gentrification and ambition. The poetry scene is alive and well, and 2022 brought the return of Sunday readings to the Maple Leaf Bar. If that's not a sign of normalcy, I don't know what is. Neo Sundari presented Green, Sides of Our Ailing Planet.
For me, poetry is not just something trapped within the two covers of a book. Poetry is the word, and the word receives animation through the sounding. Sounding is meaning, and meaning is sounding. In many of the poems, we have to interpret the lines through the kind of music. And in some poems, the music changes according to the tempo and tenor of the stanzas. And this is dictated by what those stanzas are saying. So it's a way of... Because the facts in this book are stark in many areas, really, really blatant, deliberately so. Because I'm trying to tell the world, we've been too complacent for so long. We are killing the earth, we are killing the planet. But if it is too blatant, you may alienate your audience. So why don't you introduce music into it? That we make the tablet a little easier to swallow.
Swallow, yes. So would you read for us Early Spring in City Park? There's so much of New Orleans in this book, and I love that so much.
Oh, thank you, Susan. It's not possible to live in New Orleans and not poeticize the city, because New Orleans poeticizes all of us.
It does.
It's one of the reasons my family and I chose this place about 25 years ago. A lot of music here. Early spring in City Park. Northern winds have beaten a cold retreat to their Arctic road. The oaks, ever so alive, break into olive sweat, their moss Spanish and smoothly gray, swinging soberly like a griot's beard. New poems erupt at the end of silent branches, their music mellow from the green prosody of the wind. A joyous squirrel ruffles the air with its restless tail, its pranks lean, its chuckling one moon from mature laughter. My eyes memorize these lines from the book of a wild awakening. the hibiscus's precocious budding, a riot of pollens seeking anchor in friendly places. The throaty serenade of mallard ducks gliding enviably on the chilly lake. Ah, summer's song is still a foliage away. I encounter the sun's resurrection in the leafing Galilee of Louisiana oaks.
Ah, the Galilee of Louisiana oaks. I can see it. I can see it. And the hibiscus, too.
And the hibiscus, yes.
Roger Kamenetz surveyed a life's work to assemble The Missing Jew, poems 1976 to 2023. Talk about the title, The Missing Jew, because this is an idea that has haunted your work from the very beginning. So explain to the average reader what that idea has meant to you and how you've grappled with it over time, a long time.
Yes. So, yeah, the poems began in 1976, and that was, I was 26, and that was shortly after the death of my immigrant grandfather, one of them, David Kamenetz. So I think one immediate sense was of him and all the ancestors in the world, they represented for me what they brought over from Europe. He left around 1905, and also what they left behind, language and culture, history, community. And then, of course, many more resonances of that are piled on, missing identity, missing the lost past. And then also another piece was my connection to text. So about the same time I started writing that, a dear friend, Mark Lieberman, who was sort of instrumental for a lot of my writing, had given me a complete set of these strange English translations of the Talmud by a renegade named Michael Rodkinson, who chose Victorian English to translate the language of the rabbis. And for most well-educated traditional Jews, that would have been something they learned as children. But for me, as a not very well-educated, non-traditional Reform Jew, it was all news to me. And so they were missing too. And when I began reading those texts, I heard them in the inflection of my grandfather. And so there was that connection. So that's a simple explanation, I guess.
And what was it like for you during this time of war in the Ukraine to be thinking about your Russian ancestry?
Yeah, I'm glad you put it that way. My grandfather, David, was a subject of Tsar Nicholas II, according to his papers, but he came from a town called Zegere, which is now in Lithuania near the Latvian border. You know, I wrote a long poem fairly recently called Turkey Talk for Reb Nachman, because I'd been in the Ukraine when I wrote Burnt Books in 2008. And it was really kind of an exercise in a kind of prayer practice where you talk out loud to God, screaming and shouting, rather. And I talked out loud to Reb Nachman and kind of confessed to him. So I read that poem recently, and I kind of got to this passage about the bodies in the ground from the slaughters in Reb Nachman's time, and then the slaughter that happened outside Kamenetz Podolsk in 1941, one of the first mass killings in World War II. And then, of course, today. So then again, these layers of missing people, missing Jews is stacked up.
Right. Now, of course, a work like this, as you just said, is surveying a life. And there's one poem that does that in a really beautiful way. Mm. And it's called Why I Can't Write My Autobiography, which I just love. Would you read it for us?
Sure. Thank you. Why I Can't Write My Autobiography. Anyone who has ever lived should have written a little book. The anonymous dead are unread. The next time you take a walk shaded by enormous trees, think of the rotting leaves you kick out of the way. Life is deciduous. What falls off is often more brilliant than what remains. In the Zohar, it is said, great splendor. Every life is a spark from the generator. Every spark is an angel who lives in eternity, only an instant. That instant is a man's life. and the great splendor of all these lives sparking into space as if every color in the aurora said, look at me, look at me. Just to consider an individual, even oneself, takes so much effort at distinction. It's a wonder we aren't blinded by the glare, as Isaac was, who lying on his back on the heap of burning wood, forgot his father in the presence of the Shekhinah. His eyes grew so dim, he could no longer tell Jacob from Esau, as I no longer can tell who exactly I am when I feel the brilliance of those around me. Because the desire to merge with angelic voices makes life lucid. The only way you can see through yourself, through this thick body, these ungainly bones, is in the presence of an awesome light, great splendor.
I love great splendor. Just the words make me so happy. Young Adult Fiction was a hit last year with Almost There, Farah Roshan's version of The Princess and the Frog. Also, her entry into Disney's Twisted Tales series. Chris Clarkson made a satisfying debut with That Summer Night on Frenchman Street, and Marty Dumas worked magic in Wild Seed Witch, the first book in her new series. So talk about world building in from your point of view and how you constructed the rules of the magical world you were going to use.
Right. Well, part of this actually has to do with being a middle-class Black person in New Orleans.
Right.
There are an awful lot of rules about growing up in New Orleans, especially if you're going to be on the respectable side of things. So there's a lot of things that you have to learn to be able to get along. And I think that brown children in particular get a lot of like respectability politics placed on them. And so then that combined with the idea of where my father's family is from, which is Vacherie, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. The first time that I went to Vacherie, I really literally felt like I could feel the energy of my ancestors. I know that that sounds strange, but it is a very true and was a very powerful experience for me. So much so that I knew for sure that at some point I was going to have to use it. Like when you're creative mm-hmm. and you have that little burst, you know you're going to use it. Maybe you don't know where or when, but you know that it's going to come up. And so then that feeling of magic there, like those two things came together for me, like pretty quickly. And it was really fast that, like, very obviously, y'all, there is an elite school for witches that's hidden in a sugarcane field in Vacherie. Obviously. I mean,
La Belle Demoiselle.
Les Belles Demoiselles. Pension à des sorcières.
Source. I want to see the t-shirts from the school. I mean, I'm sure they look really good. Talk about making your magic your own rather than adapting somebody else's.
Right. So I have always been an avid reader. So I'm sure that there's at least 150 magic systems like rolling around in my head because they're just a lot out of there. However, a thing that is maybe unique to me, maybe not, probably not at all, is that I actually think that people are magic. Like the power to affect other people, the power for change, the power for personal growth, I really legitimately think of as a magic. And so for me, being able to explore that feeling is almost always how magic feels. And so that combined with the prolific amount of water that we have in our area, like again, those two things kind of came together, like the personal power, the power of the self, and also the water. So like the magic system in the book, like is very water-based, even though yep. I don't literally articulate that in this book, you get a little bit more of it in the second book. But those two things put together, I really feel like Louisiana to me. And I very, very much wanted this to be grounded in what I have experienced as real Louisiana.
All that, and it's not too late to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Cajun Night Before Christmas. Who has the best Cajun accent in your family to read this classic? And then there's still time to catch the exhibit from Anne Rice's archive at Tulane University's Howard Tilton Library Special Collections. Join us next week when we look back at nonfiction and more. And until then, enjoy your holidays. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Taiwan Yu, visual artist, designer, and musician, discusses and signs the antiquarian sticker book, Imaginarium, Wednesday, December 28th at 6 at Octavia Books. Jamie Attenberg reads from and signs the paperback of I Came All This Way to Meet You, Tuesday, January 3rd from 6 to 8 at Bar Pomona, 2352 St. Claude Avenue. Ellen Hardiman discusses and signs her memoir, Pioneering in New Orleans Television, Memoir of a Starstruck Kid, Wednesday, January 4th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Two local writers will make presentations for other writers, Saturday, January 7th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The sessions, for beginners or experienced writers, are free of charge, open to the public. At 9:30 a.m., Bill Lofilm discusses cultivating suspense in your work, followed by Rolf Van Anders at 11 a.m., who will discuss yoga and the power of creativity. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.